Welcome to Seek Christ Today. I'm Beth Fernie Johnson, pastor at St. Stephen in Sylvania, Ohio. In these days of Advent, we are sharing stories. And today, one of the stories that I have is called A Stubborn Sweetness, and it's by Katherine Patterson. The call came early Christmas Eve morning. I was still asleep, and my voice must have sounded peevish when I answered the phone. "You needn't be annoyed with me, Judson," my sister said. "I can't help it." "What is it, Fran? What do you think it is? Why else would I call you at this hour?" "Father?" "Of course it's Father," she said. "The doctor is sure he won't last another day. He thinks you should come immediately." Part of me wanted to protest. I didn't want to leave my wife and children at Christmas time. What did it matter if I came or not? My father had not recognized me in ages. I dutifully went to see him 3 or 4 times a year. He would sit in his chair in the sterile nursing home, nodding at me. Sometimes, when he was most alert, he would call me Wesley. Wesley was my brother, who died in Vietnam. But usually he would mumble things I could not understand, and nod uncomprehendingly as I would vainly try to carry on a conversation. Once, he looked me straight in the face, his eyes clearing, so that I thought for a moment he knew me, and perhaps he did, for what he said was, "Tell your mother, Wesley's home." This time I nodded stupidly, not even trying to remind him that both mother and Wesley had been dead for many years. Part of me did not want to go and say goodbye to an old man who could not hear me, who had hardly listened to me even when we were both younger. And yet, I had to go. My wife understood, even though the children did not. I drove myself to the airport, bought a standby ticket, and watched 3 flights take off without me. Each time, I called my sister to ask how he was. "You've got to hurry," she'd say. But it was late afternoon before I got on the plane. When I landed, I rented a car and started the 50-mile drive. The road on which I was traveling was new, but the countryside was the farmland in which I had grown up. The sky on this Christmas Eve was clear and star-filled, spreading peace over the rolling hills and the shadow of the mountain beyond. The world of regrets and sorrow and imminent death seemed far away. I thought about my father, not the invalid he had become, but as I had known him when I was a boy. He was a strong, gruff man, a farmer who owed no man anything. If Wesley had lived, I think I might have grown up without my father ever really noticing me. Perhaps I'm unjust. I'm sure my mother would say so. She was forever trying to interpret us to each other, and for her sake, as we both grew older, we tried to understand. It was she on that terrible Christmas after Wesley's death. Just then, my headlights caught a figure stepping out into the road. I swerved and missed, but I was shaken, and as I straightened the car, my heart still pounding, I got a glimpse in the rearview mirror of the person I had nearly struck. He was in the road, waving his arms at me. Without thinking, I stopped the car and began to back slowly down the shoulder. When I got alongside, I stuck my head out the window and shouted, "Get off the road! I nearly hit you!" It wasn't a man. It was a young girl, her hair streaming across a rucksack on her back. She wore no hat or gloves. "Yeah," her chin was up, "watch where you're going." Then suddenly, almost coy, "Hey, give me a ride to town." Without waiting for me to answer, she reached behind me, unlatched the back door, and was in the car before I could protest. As I shifted into drive and moved out into the road, she swung the pack from off her back and put it on the seat beside her. I had seen enough of her face now to realize that she was about the age of my daughter Jenny, who was barely 14. "Where are you headed?" I asked, trying to sound casual. "Who needs to know?" "No one," I couldn't help wondering. "You remind me of my daughter." "Well, I ain't. Lucky you." We drove on in silence. She was wrestling something from her rucksack. I switched on the radio. But then I heard a hard, round pressure against my right shoulder. "Shut that thing off," she ordered. I turned off the radio, too amazed to be truly frightened. Where on earth had the child gotten a gun? "Now pass me back your wallet and watch. Anything valuable?" "I'll have to stop the car first." "Okay, but no fooling around here. I eased the car onto the shoulder and shut off the engine. She held the gun, pointing roughly at my right ear, while I got out of the car, took off my watch and wedding ring, unloaded the pockets of my coat and my trousers. I put the contents onto the passenger seat. Her hand was shaking as the gun followed my every move. I wasn't afraid she would shoot deliberately, but her anxiety, she might accidentally. And then, as I straightened up to close the door, I looked more closely at the trembling weapon. The car's dim overhead light gave away its secret. The gun was a toy. My impulse was to grab it, laughing, but the look on her face stopped me. Instead, I shut the door and began walking down the road. She yelled after me, "Where do you think you're going?" "I thought you wanted the car as well." "Come back here," she said, her voice breaking. "I can't drive." I came back and got in. The gun was at my shoulder at once. "Now go," she said, "and don't try to make a fool out of me again." She wasn't crying, but she was close to it. "You know, don't use the credit cards." "Shut up and drive." "Seriously, they'll give you right away. There's about $200 in cash, and the day after tomorrow you should be able to pawn the watch for at least $100. It's antique gold. What's with you?" "I'm trying to help. I ran away from home once. It's no fun." "I don't need help." "Well, you do need money. You can't get far without that." "Don't I know," she mumbled. After a minute, she poked me hard with the plastic gun barrel. "You on the level about the credit cards?" she asked. "I swear they're not worth it. I'd have to report them stolen." "What about the watch and stuff?" "If you let me have my wedding ring and the credit cards, you can take the money and the watch, and I'll consider them a Christmas present. Meaning, I won't even call the police." "Mr. Santa Claus himself," her voice was sarcastic. But the pressure on my shoulder lessened for a moment, and she jabbed me hard. "You putting me on? I could kill you, you know." "But it wouldn't be smart," I said. "And you don't strike me as a dumb person." "That isn't what my dad said, and he should know." "Fathers aren't always right. My father..." "Forget your father." "I can't forget my father," I said. "He's dying. That's where I'm going, to see him once more before he dies." "Dying? Oh, it's all right. He's very old and sick. He's ready to die." "Ask him. You might get another opinion." "You think so?" "I don't want to talk about it." "Well, you're young." "But I might die," she blurted out. "Oh, God, I might die." The gun fell from my shoulder to the floor as she put both hands to her face and began to cry. You dropped your gun," I said quietly. She stopped crying instantly, snatched up the gun, poked me 3 or 4 times, then dropped it again. "You knew it was fake all the time, didn't you?" I nodded. "My dad is right. I'm the dumbest girl in the world." "You're not so dumb." "Yeah, then how come I'm pregnant?" she was almost yelling. "Is that why you ran away?" "It was either that or get thrown out. He don't care if I live or die, long as I don't bother him." The first thought was to rush in with words of reassurance. Of course her father cared. Even now he must be calling the state police, asking them to help him find her. But I kept quiet. I knew I was thinking of my father, what he would have done. I didn't know this child's father, and suddenly I wanted to give her my father for all his sternness and anger and doubts, because I knew what my father would have done. "May I tell you a story?" For an answer, she blew her nose loudly. "It was in 1967," I began, realizing that the Christmas of 1967 was as remote to her as the first Christmas. In early November, we had word through the Red Cross that my brother Wesley was dead. His plane had crashed over North Vietnam 2 years before. He died in prison. For a minute, the cold pain of Wesley's death returned. I had just adored him. "So?" she prompted, impatient to be done. "It wasn't only that he was dead, but the way he died that hurt my father so. I think if he'd been killed in the crash, my father would have been able to bear it. But it was the waste, the agony of his dying bit by bit in prison." "You do a lot of talking about dying," she said. "Sorry. I'm trying to figure out why my father was so terribly bitter. He'd always been a very religious person. He even named his sons after church heroes. But once he got the news about Wesley, he stopped going to church, stopped saying grace at meals. He even tried to keep my mother from taking me and my sister to Sunday school. I was only 9. I didn't understand. "Easy," she said. "Sometimes you gotta pay God back." Well, Christmas came, and I was supposed to sing a solo in the Sunday Christmas program. I was all excited about it, and so was my mother. I could tell that even my sister, who usually ignored me, was proud that I had been chosen. The night of the program, my mother tried to persuade my father to go. I was a bit afraid of my father. I was worried that if he went, he might be disappointed in me, so I wasn't sure I really wanted him to go, but I wanted my mother to be happy. That was the real reason I wanted him to go. "You should have left him alone." "Yeah, we should have, I guess." Anyhow, at supper time, my mother said that he owed it to me to go, that it was a big night in my life, and that he would be proud to hear how well I sang. "He can sing it right here in the kitchen for me," my father said. "You should have done it." I did. I stood there in the kitchen after supper while I drank his coffee and I sang for him. Do you know the song, "There's a Song in the Air"? "I don't know classical. I don't like it either." "Don't worry, I won't sing it for you," I said. But I sang it for him, and the more I sang, the more frightened I became. I could tell he was about to burst with rage. Even before I finished, he slammed his fist on the table and sloshed coffee all over the tablecloth. "Lies," he yelled. "It's all lies." Then he jumped up and grabbed me by the shoulders. He was like a crazy man. "Don't you know what the world is like, Judson? There's no pretty angels flapping their wings. There's no singing in the sky. There's hate and suffering and cruel, cruel death." Then he shoved me aside and grabbed my mother. "I don't see it, Agnes. How can you hang on to all this nonsense? The air is not full of music. It's full of bombs crashing and people screaming." My mother's voice, her face tightened, and she said very quietly, "The song is louder." My father began to curse. I had never heard him speak a word to my mother in anger, and now, all because of me, because I wanted to sing in the stupid Christmas program, he was cursing her. I ran out of the house. It was a cold night, but it was a long time before I slowed down enough to notice. I was never going back. He had always despised me, I told myself. It was only for Wesley's sake that he put up with me. Now Wesley was gone, so I was going too. Before I knew it, I was deep in the woods, almost at the foot of that mountain over there, just as lost as I could be, and it was bitter cold. "I take it you didn't freeze to death," she said sarcastically. "No, I kept walking, but it was a perfectly black night with no moon. I couldn't even see a tree before I bumped into it. I was terrified. I was sure I was going to die out there in the cold dark all alone." "Yeah," she said, without a trace of sarcasm. And then, suddenly, I saw a light way off in the distance. I began to stumble toward it. It was the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen in my life, that light. I still couldn't see where I was walking, but it didn't matter. I just kept my eyes on the light. "And you ran smack into the angel of the Lord God Almighty." No, it was my father. He'd come out to look for me. "So he falls down on his knees and begs you to forgive him, and you live happily ever after." No, I just went home with him. It was too late by then for any of us to go to the program. So that was that. We never spoke about it again. "You can let me out here," she said. I hadn't realized that we were already at the edge of town. "I don't like to just drop you off this time of my night." "No problem." "Look, we're almost at the nursing home. Why don't you wait? As soon as I've seen my father, I can take you wherever you want to go." She made a sound meant to be a laugh. "Don't do me any favors, mister." I pulled up in front of the nursing home. When I'd parked, I put on my wedding ring, took the money out of my wallet, and laid it on the front seat. "I don't want your watch," she said. "You can take it." "Thanks," I said. "Why don't you wait? I won't be a bit a minute." And then she jerked her head in a nod. "You're too late," Fran said. "He's not responding to anyone now." I went to the bedside and took my father's big hand. It was thinner than I'd remembered. He looked peaceful. "He recognized me this afternoon," Fran said. "He spoke to me." "Did he?" I was remembering the light, how he had come for me that night through the darkness. It didn't make much sense, she continued. His voice was stronger than it's been in years. He said, tell your mother the song is louder. I'll be right back, I said, almost running out. The car was empty. I opened the front door to be sure. The light revealed a $20 bill on the seat. She hadn't wanted to leave me penniless. I never saw her again. I could not tell her my father's last words. Not that she would have understood. But then, in a way, he was wrong. Both he and my mother were wrong. The song is not louder. It swallowed up quickly in the cry of anger or the clack of greed. No, the song is not louder, but it persists. It comes as it had come to me beside my father's bed, a melody of the most stubborn sweetness for which we are never prepared. And we turn away from it again and again and again. But, oh, my child, I said to the empty night, even though the song is not louder, it is stronger. And someday it will find you out there alone in the darkness. Then I turned and went back in to say goodbye to my father. The end. Some questions to ponder. In the story, who do you most relate to? And what do you think about Judson's comment? Is the song, and his dad, is the song more persistent? Is it louder? Is it stronger? How has that all worked in your life? And how do you see it working in the lives of others around you? If you'd like to explore these questions, please go to our Facebook page, Seek Christian. I'd also invite you to visit a local church where you can build relationships that will continue to help you grow in faith. With you on the journey, as together we seek Christ, please tune in again next week. Blessings.